All right, dude, let's start by introducing ourselves. We're two PhD scientists who met on TikTok. We now work together as cannabis research scientists at Real Isolates, studying rare cannabinoids in smoke. My name is Riley, and I have my PhD in pharmaceutical sciences, specializing in natural product chemistry. I'm really passionate about cannabis, and I'm a daily user, but I've met very few other researchers who are.
Well, I definitely think that's why we hit it off. I'm Miyabi. I also have my PhD in pharmaceutical sciences, but I studied the system in the brain that causes the effects of cannabis. Riley and I have very complementary backgrounds that bring a unique perspective to cannabis science, and we love breaking it down so it's easy to understand. This episode covers our journeys into becoming cannabis scientists, some of the challenges of research that are not often discussed, and some of the unique facts about cannabis that we find the most interesting. So let's get this session started.
All right, let's do it. Natural product because nature is the best organic chemist in the world.
Welcome to Smoke and Science. Nothing but the facts about our favorite plant.
So, Miyabi, I don't know if I've ever asked you this, but how did you get into cannabis or how'd you get interested in cannabis?
Honestly, my interest came from personal life experience. The first time that I ever used cannabis, it was a life-changing event for me. I can't put into words how, well, actually, I guess I'll try to put into words how it made me feel. I guess the experience of using cannabis for the first time and of like altering my endocannabinoid system for the first time really pointed out to me that I could exist in this world. And it was something that was hugely beneficial for my brain, and it was something I couldn't ignore. And from that moment, I became obsessed with understanding why. And that one thing led to another. And I'm still surprised even, even today that like where it actually led to and all the things that I discovered on the way, because there's so much, that we know. But for me, it was definitely a personal experience. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have used cannabis for a long time and been interested just because of the way it made me feel. But I definitely became interested in natural products as a whole. When I was young, growing up in Maine, I would grab plants and fungi and extract them and just kind of research them and be like, oh, that's cool. People use this traditionally for X, Y, or Z. But even after I graduated from undergrad, I started working in a lab and I realized that really what I loved doing was making these teas and tinctures and researching it. But I didn't know that there was a career possibility in natural product chemistry. So once I discovered what I genuinely enjoyed doing, I found that program, pharmacognosy, as they call it. And it wasn't until later in my PhD that I realized that not only was I passionate about cannabis and how it alters my body, but a ton of other people were too. And now it's just so much fun to talk about and communicate and continue learning for myself and for everyone.
Yeah, I think it's so funny that so you're a natural products chemist, and in terms for what both of us do, like both of us in pharmaceutical sciences, when you get your PhD, you're educated in like a very specific way. Like we both have a very specific education about drugs and drug discovery and the value of these natural products. And yeah, I'm so glad that we met because it's somewhat rare to come across another scientist that's in our field with our degrees who feels comparably to what we do in terms of like using tons of natural products in our real lives. And I think it's really funny that we met on TikTok.
It is very funny. And just to your point of actually using natural products, I mean, there's so many people, even in the natural product field, who never ever use any natural products because you can either take the natural product chemistry route saying, okay, we can discover actual drugs to give to, cancer patients undergoing chemotherapy. And that's absolutely a valid route, but it's also, you know, you can take it as supplements and as preventative medicine rather than pharmaceutical drugs as well. And you can have some sort of hybrid opinion of it as well.
The same could be said, like totally the same thing could be said about endocannabinoid system research, which is the system in the brain that I'll be talking about a lot today that causes the effects of cannabis, where there's certainly a population of people who are cannabis users, but there's also a large population of people who study it who just don't have that first-person experience. And I've always felt like first-person experience really rounds out the perspective in terms of understanding the pros and the cons of these natural products and their uses, and being able to communicate that with other people in a way that isn't, you know, there are pros and there are cons. And I think that for both of us, we feel like we're somewhere in between sensationalism and saying like there's absolutely no cons, and then the negative propaganda of saying that there's no therapeutic effect. Like neither one of those things is true. And I think that there's a void of that information.
I absolutely agree. But I mean, that's kind of just a product of, you know, what traditional research institutions kind of provide. It's usually either one side or the other. And typically in almost any situation, I find that it's better to go somewhere in the middle, whether it be politics or cannabis or really anything.
I think it's good to be able to see both sides, weigh either option, also hear out both sides of, you know, of information, because information is not unbiased, even though I think that we always strive towards that. Humans in general are naturally biased. And I think that's something that like you and I always strive to do, is to see like that there's either these either sides. That's one of the reasons why I think we get along, is because neither one of us minds having our opinion challenged. Actually, I enjoy it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it makes one for great conversation. But you also learn a lot about other people by asking their opinion in a non-confrontational way, just a curiosity-rich way, I think has a lot of power.
So I totally think that that's important. And I think it's important in cannabis, and it's a piece of what, specifically with educating and science communication, I think a piece that's missing is that personal connection to the community. And I hope that that's something that we can, you know, address here. You know, I really hope that we can bring high level cannabis science into a realm of discussion for everyone, because everyone's opinions are so valuable. And I've learned a lot from TikTok. I've learned a lot from, and it's maybe I'm not necessarily social media. I've learned a lot from the followers who are sharing their experiences with me. And as a scientist, I never would have gotten that type of information other than by asking everyone, like asking other
users. I mean, yeah, absolutely, asking users for sure, but also creating a comfortable environment on your page that makes people want to contribute to conversations. Even if you're not blatantly asking, people will comment in very nice ways and say, hey, this is how this made me feel, does anyone else feel this way? And then there'll be a whole thread of comments under that of people relating to that first person, and it is so cool to read those comments and learn from a real discussion happening on a video that you made.
And then for it to come back like full circle, at least like to, as for both of us being scientists, when we met and we were talking about things, like there were a couple of things that that both of us have been discussing, like edibles and metabolism, the fact that like up about 20% of people can't feel edibles, we would not have been interested, or not even that we wouldn't have been interested, we would not have been made aware of that phenomenon if we weren't spending our time actually talking to the people who are using cannabis products. And I think it's something that fuels another piece of the reason why we want to do this podcast, or why this podcast came about, is because it gives us the opportunity to go into more detail than like a 60-second video would. And we're always going to take questions and like from our listeners and our viewers, and this is something that I think is I'm really excited to be able to go into like a little more detail at least.
Absolutely. I mean, the 60 seconds is it's nice. You can get a certain amount of information across, but it's often hard to give the background information necessary to understand a even slightly complex topic in 60 seconds, and then give the information that you actually want to give in that video, and then any context around it. That's very difficult to do in 60 seconds when you're just kind of slapping it at the TikTok community.
Although I will say your 60-second video of G protein coupled receptor signaling was like the reason why I ended up reaching out to you. I was like, what is this? This is amazing. This is university level biochemistry, or specifically pharmacology, receptor pharmacology. And I think that that's sort of, that's the vibe that for anyone who's like newer to listening to us, that's the vibe that we're going for here. We're going to talk about college level science, but we're going to do it in a way that hopefully is not painful.
Right, not painful and always relating to something that you experience. So when we talk about GPCRs, we're talking about cannabinoid receptors, and it's absolutely relatable to people who use cannabis, and we're going to make sure that people understand it in that context and not in a boring context. Or that's our
Right.
goal.
And GPCRs are the major target of most pharmaceutical drugs. It's a giant class of receptors. It's a type, basically like a type of receptor, which is kind of like a type of an on and off switch in the body. And it's how a very large and significant portion of pharmaceutical drugs work.
I think it's funny the GPCR video that you're referencing. I either got like amazing feedback from that video, or people are like, "Why on earth are you putting this on TikTok? This is absurd. I've never seen anything like this on TikTok. Like, try less hard."
You
And I'm like, "I
had like a little graphic and everything. Like, it was great.
I literally made a PowerPoint for that video, but I enjoyed making it, and at least you enjoyed it. That makes
I'm
me
so
happy.
glad you made it because when that came up on TikTok, I was like, wow, it might have been one of the reasons why I continued to be on the app. Just in general, I was like, this can be done. Like, and there's interest in this high level science, which has been something that really blew me away, is how many people are interested in this science. And it's, I think it has to do with, feeling a sense of empowerment in understanding. At least I did, right? Like when I went in to do my PhD, the entire purpose of me doing my PhD was to understand what cannabis was doing in my brain. I needed to understand that. And I don't think that you need your PhD to understand that. I think that the concepts are very tangible to others. And I think that when we met up for the first time and we're chatting about it, like one of the things that really struck me was how both of us said like that we felt this larger community of people who were interested in it and applying it to their personal lives, and how for both of us, that's the end goal would be to break down that barrier because we're both incredibly privileged to be scientists and there's huge barriers to entry to scientific research. And I think that in one of the things that we talked about over avocado toast was that we as millennials over avocado toast, one of the things that we touched on that I'm really excited to be here with you today doing is about starting the process of making this information available, just available, because it exists.
Absolutely. And I think we're in this unique position where people use cannabis and feel differently. You know that something's changing in your brain chemistry, in your body, and providing the information to kind of connect that information with what's happening in your body. Like, of course people are interested. I'm interested in learning. Everyone's interested because you can feel it and you can feel those positive changes in your life if you use cannabis in a way that suits your body correctly. And I think that's super powerful for people to understand and feel.
And on the flip side too, like the more you learn to understand that positive effect, the more rounded your routine can become to like decrease the negative effects because they do exist, although they're not always the caveat with this. To my knowledge, cannabis is the safest drug that we have ever discovered. In terms of toxicity, there's no acute overdose dosage. That doesn't mean that there isn't any, that there's zero possible negative effects, though. They do exist. So I think that that's one other piece of it that, as two scientists, like we, as two scientists who use the cannabis plant ourselves, we can see both of those. We can see the extreme positive. We can see the other side of the negatives that people are talking about. And they have real explanations for why they happen. And there are ways that you can, change your usage. You can change and monitor your cannabis use to get the biggest positive effects with more minimal negative effects. I mean, both of us have talked about this because neither one of us really takes tolerance breaks, even though that's something that everyone talks a lot about. And a piece of that has to do with our routine, like the way in which we both monitor our usage. And I think the hope here is that, we're going to talk about research, and then we're going to talk about how you can apply that research to your life, even though research is done at a different scale and is done a lot of the times in animal models. There's no reason why you can't take the information from research and think about it in terms of how you could apply that to your routine, how it could change the way that you view your relationship with cannabis.
Yeah, so both of us don't take proper tolerance breaks, but that's because we monitor our cannabis use pretty carefully. So I think both of us have like a small little weed journal that we'll record if we try a new strain, and how it makes us feel, how much we're using. And then over time, you can see if it's taking more and more of a product to feel the same way, your tolerance is getting higher. So instead of just completely abstaining from cannabis, we just reduce the amount of cannabis that we're using. We know that cannabis is used medically by many people, and taking a full-blown tolerance break where you completely abstain from cannabis is not realistic for many people. So either reducing the amount you're using, switching up the ways you're using it. So if you're used to using concentrates, maybe try some flower. Or if you have a really high THC flower, maybe try to find a lower THC flower. And that way, you're still going to functionally lower your tolerance, but you're still able to get the benefits of cannabis. And we talk about this a lot. I think many people are under the assumption that there isn't a lot of research on cannabis and in the body, but I mean, we have decades of research about the endocannabinoid system, about the molecules in cannabis. It's just it's usually not displayed, to the public, but also in a way that is accessible and understandable to everyone because
So,
it's a huge
okay.
barrier.
I had a funny realization the other day. The endocannabinoid system, which is the system in the brain and body that interacts with cannabis, the endocannabinoid system is a millennial.
Oh, wow.
I think that that's it was just a really funny, it was just something that I thought was a funny like relation to it. Like so whenever like and of course there's a lot of there's a lot of propaganda and there's a lot of, I think, bias out there when we say that there's not enough research for cannabis because we literally have had documented medical use of cannabis for over 4,000 years. The first documented use was in the BC times. And it's been, the plant itself has been used and cultivated specifically for therapeutic purposes for thousands and thousands of years. We don't have that much information about traditional pharmaceuticals. And it's right. Often, we often have this double standard about research, but the endocannabinoid system, so every person, every human, every warm-blooded animal has an endocannabinoid system. It's a very important system in the brain. It's in the whole body. And it happens to be what I did my entire PhD on, so I'm incredibly biased from that end as well. But in my opinion, it's the most important system in the brain and body. It is. Well,
and also, I just want to interject because I've received these comments a lot on TikTok. I think people often think that you need cannabis for your endocannabinoid system to work and to function. So when you say like, kangaroos have an endocannabinoid system, and everyone's like, oh, where are they getting their pot? It's like, no. Like, they have an endocannabinoid system that works and operates completely perfectly fine without that animal ever interacting with cannabis, the plant.
And that our endocannabinoid systems they function in the body to do very important things. Like, when people, I've come across that as well, people saying like, it doesn't, the CB1 receptors never become activated until you use cannabis, which is not true. That's a myth, because our CB1 receptors are very important from the time that we are literally during neurodevelopment, during when you're pregnant, when you're a baby, when you're going through puberty. They're important all throughout our entire lives, from the very moment we are conceived until the moment that we die. They are providing a very key function in the body. They regulate metabolism, immune system, and inflammation, overall brain chemistry. Like, I think one of the biggest reasons why the endocannabinoid system is so important is that it regulates all of the other systems. So like serotonin and dopamine, GABA, the opioid system, we know about these systems more. Oh, and that was going back to what I was saying about it being a millennial, is that, you know, the serotonin system is more like a boomer. Like, it's, I'm not, without going too far into like the generational stereotypes.
I love
here,
this.
I'm not saying anything positive or negative about that. I'm just trying to say the age. I'm trying to just disclose the actual age of the systems here. So serotonin was discovered in 1948, and anandamide, the endocannabinoid that all of our bodies make that activate cannabinoid receptors, wasn't discovered until 1992. This gives the serotonin system about a 40-year jump on the endocannabinoid system, and it's one of the reasons why the serotonin system is so centrally placed in the dogma of our medical literature for neuroscience, while the endocannabinoid system is often overlooked. But what's really interesting is that as research has evolved in the last few decades, we've found that neuroscience is far more complex than we ever could have imagined, and that there's way more interactions between the systems than we anticipated before. And there's more research needed in all realms, not just the endocannabinoid system, which is something that we're about to talk about next. As scientists, we are always going to say that we need more research, because we're incredibly biased in that way of being like, we absolutely will always need more research. Yes, bring the data. Like,
right. I mean, we need more research on drugs that have been on the market forever, like Lipitor. We need more research on Lipitor. We need more research on everything.
I could not agree with you more. I think a point in case is SSRIs, specifically Prozac. Its drug name is fluoxetine. And within this last year, like this calendar year 2021, there was a recent publication that came out that shows an entirely new molecular mechanism for fluoxetine. So often we call Prozac an SSRI, and that entire class of antidepressants, they're antidepressants. SSRI stands for selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. But we also know that they increase levels of endocannabinoids, they alter other signaling systems. And very, very recently this year, we found an entirely new mechanism of action for them that has more to do with a different receptor class, a receptor and a growth factor that is more normally associated. I guess it's normally more associated BDNF with dopamine and I'm not positive, but I've always thought about it in terms of Parkinson's. That's been the main association I have with BDNF, although this molecule has many, many uses in the brain. There's been a new mechanism that comes out for Prozac, this year, and we just don't hold these molecules to the same standard, is I guess where I was going with that in terms of needing more research.
Well, we say, oh, it works, it does
But does
something
it?
and it,
I
well,
mean, well, so
yeah.
it does work for a population. And like antidepressants absolutely work. But there's a significant population for which they don't work. Right?
Absolutely.
There's a significant population of people who experience like very negative side effects. I happen to be part of that population, so I'm disclosing my bias again about this.
Do we think we can give that paper to listeners to read if they're
Oh,
interested?
absolutely. We'll link it in let's
Yeah.
link it in the
Yeah, let's link it.
So if you want to check out that paper, the link is in the description below. Down there is also a link to our Instagram at Smokinol, where you can send us any comments, questions about the paper, or suggestions for future podcasts. Our next episode is a deep dive into the mechanism of cannabis and pain, and how the endocannabinoid system plays a key role in the process. We're also going to cover anxiety, paranoia, and appetite. But if you have anything specific you want to learn about, please give us a shout. All right, now we're going to take a quick break before we get back to the science.
Smokinol is a unique cannabis extract that feels more like smoking compared to traditional edibles. That's because it's actually extracted from cannabis smoke. Smokinol can be incorporated into a variety of formulations, including edibles, tinctures, and capsules. And smokinol extraction is fast, easy, and requires very little upfront investment. If you work at a dispensary or are involved in cannabis processing and are interested in incorporating smokinol formulations for your products, contact the link below or send us a message on Instagram. Smokinol, we smoked it for you.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Hope you had a very relaxing break. Now we're going to kind of transition into talking about Miyabi and myself working together and how much of an adventure it has already been.
When Riley and I first met, our original project that we planned to do together is write an entire theory out, which we are in the process of doing. But a piece of this theory has to do with natural products and how we think natural products work in the body. And finding someone else with their PhD in pharmaceutical sciences who happens to have researched natural products, who also happens to have used them, and then to have the synergy where it's not just our backgrounds, but it's our belief about how that works at a molecular level. I mean, that's something that I just think is like an incredible gift. And I'm so excited to share this theory once we get ourselves together and write it. That
And
is.
just the concept of writing a theory paper was so exciting to me because, I went to graduate school and I'm used to this kind of cut and dry, like you have your introduction methods, you report it all, it's hard data, you can't claim anything that you did not explicitly find. And then Miyabi was like, let's write a theory paper. And I was like, this is my dream. So absolutely, this is how I think very abstractly. So I was just so excited about it, and I still am.
This theory summarizes our combined perspective of the beneficial effects of natural products and came about from both of our experiences getting our PhDs and realizing what barriers to research exist, which is actually our next topic. It is true that as scientists, we can't publish things that we did not explicitly find in the data. And it's also true that both of us are trained. We are trained very specifically to look at data critically, to look at our own findings and not extrapolate them or sensationalize them, which is something that we both completely understand and Like, it's, that's not to put a fault on scientific publication at all. That's how it should be.
But yeah, it needs that rigor, just so people aren't claiming absurd things from like very minimal findings.
Oh, absolutely. It definitely needs that. And then on the flip side, it kind of creates this giant gap between the research and the tangible outcome in like us, I guess. And
yeah, and utility, like using your findings from research in your everyday life. You need to think pretty abstractly, because you're not going to use a lot of information that's in publications, because it is so cut and dry that it's just a very explicit fact. It's not like, oh, well, you could use this information in this sense to help with this. It's just very cut and dry.
And there's no way, because of the way scientific research is structured, which is to eliminate variables. So all scientific experiments are conducted in a way to minimize and limit like outside variables or outside interest. And the real world, like reality, is just an infinite number of variables and variability. And I think that it's one of the things that's so intriguing. We came at science from opposite ends. You came at science from using natural products from the start. Your journey.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've always been interested in natural products. Many people that I'm around use natural products, but nobody really understood how these natural products interacted with our body, because scientific publications are not written in a way for the public to understand. And I was one of those people trying to read these publications going, what language is this written in? Because I have no idea what they're saying. So, you know, I went to graduate school to understand these publications, to understand what these natural products are doing in our body, and to also understand where the gaps in research are and where possibly I could fit in to help fill those gaps.
I feel like jargon, so scientific jargon is that language. It's this incredibly, like, and I understand why it's there, because it makes everything very precise, right? Like you were talking about being very specific, very cut and dry, very, but it makes it very, unapproachable and also just very, very difficult to understand. And with natural products too, with research, one of the problems that I think is that we come across is the fact that when you're trying to limit variables, natural products come from living things. Natural products like cannabis and like all cannabis extracts and like cannabis products that are full spectrum, cannabis products that are not distilled or isolated, the products that are what we would call crude products, they're incredibly, incredibly complicated mixtures. And there is variability because they come from a living thing. They come from life. The cannabis plant is alive. And life is so complicated, and I think that that's magical. I mean, that to me, like, that was one of the things that we geeked out about together originally, was just how magical we find that. And that for both of us, the goal is not to reduce that magic, right? Like,
no, I mean, a plant is putting a certain amount of energy into producing all of these different molecules. And that essentially is what natural product chemistry is. It's studying plants, bacteria, fungi, algae, any of these specimens, and understanding what the molecules that they make are and what they use them for, and then how humans can also use those molecules for our own uses and purposes. It's typically, even though the plant or bacteria or whatever, even though they're making hundreds of thousands of different compounds, we typically isolate a single compound and then study that single compound, which is not a good picture of what's actually happening in the plant and how the plant is actually protecting itself. The plant's going to produce a whole repertoire of molecules that have a similar purpose, and they're going to use it when they feel they need to, or if a certain gene pathway is shut off, they're going to be able to produce a different molecule that's going to serve that purpose. So really, there's just this untapped potential of natural products, especially when we think about combining different natural products in different ratios for specific therapeutic benefits.
And that is paralleled in the human body. We also have that same level of complexity in our signaling systems. And I have a question. So did you ever have a moment where, because I called it magical earlier, and I still think that it's magical, but did you ever have a moment where you like understood that magic? You know how magicians like never show their hand, and like magicians like don't like it's. I had this like moment during my PhD where it kind of came together, and it's still magical, but where there is a reason for that magic, I don't know.
I don't think I had a specific moment, but I think it was in like my second or third year of my PhD where I finally started like connecting all of these concepts that I was learning about and what I was like tangibly like using in the laboratory. And I was kind of like, this is absolutely unbelievable that, you know, one, that all of these plants are making all these different compounds, but two, that like we have the tools and ability to like assess this, and I get to do this. I'm so stoked that I get to do this. And that goes back to, you know, privilege. Absolutely. I have a privilege of being in that position, but I just, it was magical to hands-on be dealing with that and to understand it. And honestly, even when you mess up in a lab, it's still kind of cool that you're doing something so complex that, I don't know, when you mess up, you can kind of figure it out.
Well, you're always learning, right? So like even when you mess something up, you might find out, I mean, a lot of scientific discoveries were accidents.
Oh my gosh. I loved making mistakes during my grad career because that's when I learned the most. And all of my undergraduate students would be very afraid to make mistakes. And I'm like, nah, dude, go right after it. Like, you're going to learn so much by the mistakes you make. And they're like, no. Like, I'm really scared. And I'm like, nope, you just got to go for it. Like, you'll thank yourself later.
I think that applies just to life in general, too. Being able to, like, learn from them and think about it and say like, all right, like something that came out of this, like overall, like I think, and I've made a lot of mistakes in my life, certainly, but I think that similar to what you're saying, like I've learned way more from those mistakes than I did from things that I've gotten right or done right. And like in the lab and in science in general, in the community, it's hard because we only publish positive data, which means that when you read a scientific paper or when someone's talking about like a scientific discovery, it's positive data. It's something that worked.
It's the two things that worked out of the 2,000 things you tried.
Yeah, it's usually about that ratio about it too. Which is really, it's a difficult concept because unfortunately it means that when you make a mistake or when something doesn't go according to plan or when it's negative data, that it never actually gets published or it never reaches it never reaches the general public. And I think that with specifically, now I'm going to talk about grant funding for just a second, without going too deep into the rabbit hole. Science, for people who don't know about how science is paid for and the money that goes into science, a lot of it is done by grant-structured grant funding, a significant portion of which comes from the government. And these grants are given based on a proposal that you write. And when you write that proposal, you do write in there what you expect to find. You do write in that proposal why you think your research is important and why the research deserves funding. And in the process of then getting the funding and doing the research, you are constantly trying to find the answer that you proposed. It doesn't always work that way. You can't always find it. But the reason why you are trying to find that answer is because writing and publishing that answer will help you get more funding. And so It's just something that I think about a lot with cannabis and with cannabinoid research, because the funding has largely been given through the lens of looking at it negatively, through the lens of finding it as a Schedule I federal drug of abuse. And even in my research that I did with the endocannabinoid system, it was through the lens of looking for synthetic new cannabinoids, right? Like, I was in drug discovery, and I think that's another reason why we, like, you and I have such complementary backgrounds, even in the sense of like how we approached the problem, or not the problem, but the hypothesis, right? Like, from your approach, you were looking at the source of the natural products. You were looking at cyanobacteria, you were looking at the hemp cannabis plant, like. And from my approach, I was looking at the system in the brain and body and approaching it synthetically to make a synthetic pharmaceutical, which a large number of them are actually based upon like molecules that you would have isolated from nature.
Oh, of course. It's about 60% of pharmaceutical drugs are at least partially modeled after a natural product, because nature is the best organic chemist in the world. It makes incredibly complex molecules that even synthetic organic chemists have no idea how to make. And I made a few TikToks on Taxol. It's a chemotherapeutic drug. I mean, it took a decade to learn how to synthesize that, and we still use a precursor from the plant because it's such a complex structure.
Living things are our ability as living things to create molecules that are active is something that still to this day, I think, blows my mind in terms of cannabis and the cannabinoids, how the cannabis plant will make THC, CBD, and all the other rare cannabinoids, and how that then can interact with our system in our brain and body to cause its effects is something that I don't think I'll ever get bored of trying to understand and thinking about how that alters brain chemistry and or body chemistry.
Absolutely. And I'm going to introduce a topic here, or a word, two words, secondary metabolites. And secondary metabolites are these active molecules that either a plant, bacteria, or fungus, they're going to make these molecules that are not used for their reproduction or for the metabolism. It's used for another purpose, whether it be fighting off other bacteria, fungi, or there's a million different ways a secondary metabolite can be used. And that's
protection, right? Like protection of like the sun.
The sun, like a sunscreen. So that's what a secondary metabolite is. And that's pretty much the drugs that come from natural products are secondary metabolites, because that organism is making that compound to fight something. And then we say, oh, I wonder what we could use that compound for, because it's clearly active in some way against other things.
So like another example of secondary metabolites that the cannabis community is very familiar with, but the general public is as well, is this class of molecules called terpenes that are present in essential oils. They're present in like, so most herbs in like your garden or herbs in your kitchen, pretty much anything that smells, right? Like anything that has a smell will contain this class of molecules called terpenes, and they're secondary metabolites. And I think it's really interesting. I don't think I've come across a single terpene that doesn't have antibacterial, antimicrobial, antibiotic like activities at certain concentrations. And I think it's really, really interesting. Almost all of them, to my knowledge, all of the ones that I've looked into have displayed antibacterial activity. And a piece of that is because the plants make them for that purpose. Like the cannabis plant also needs to be able to fight off bacteria to live. It needs to have.
Right. I mean, like humans, you know, we have these arms and fingers and legs. So if we encounter an issue, we run away or we pull something out of our pocket to help fight, right? A plant can't do that. So it has this repertoire of molecules that it's going to use instead, where it can fight off many different things, and it can upregulate genes to produce different molecules depending on the situation that it's in.
So I'll introduce a term now that has to do with secondary metabolites. So secondary metabolites being are the molecules in the plant, right? Like the cannabinoids, the terpenes. Also should mention that the plant has a lot more than that. It has active fatty acids. It has flavonoids. It has structural components. So the plant has this large number of molecules that are called secondary metabolites if it doesn't contribute to reproduction or to growth. And all of those molecules together, that like mosaic or mixture of a large number of molecules, makes up something that we call chemodiversity, or a diversity of the molecules or chemicals that are present in the plant. And that's actually the topic of the theory paper that Riley and I are writing together, is chemodiversity, or this large mixture, how the chemodiversity in the plant applies to the chemodiversity in the human brain and body. Because just like secondary metabolites in plants, just like how the cannabis plant has the entourage effect, right, of terpenes and cannabinoids, the human brain and body also has an entourage effect. In fact, that was the original use of the word entourage effect. Now, I go on a super long tangent here that I'm going to spare you all from, but at the end of the day, what I'm describing is the fact that inside all of our bodies and all of our brains, we have an incredibly complicated system and an incredibly complicated interaction between the different systems, all that are made up of different molecules like neurotransmitters, including the endocannabinoids. Chemodiversity, or this large mixture of molecules in the plant, you know, it exists. We have, humans also have chemodiversity. And this is the theory paper that we are working on and that we've been nerding out. And it's actually, I feel like it's the seed of our friendship of...
Oh my gosh. We actually were writing something else recently, and we just went on this absolute like rampage writing just a bunch of incredibly interesting paragraphs. And we're like, well, that was really helpful for the chemodiversity paper, but it has nothing to do with what we're supposed to be doing right now.
It has nothing to do with this like chapter that we need to finish. And we were like, well, we'll save that for theory.
But it's so fun to write about. And I think a good way to conceptualize what chemodiversity is, if you think of just the molecule THC, just THC, so you have to isolate that from the cannabis plant. If you think of just THC, that is not a chemodiverse sample. It is just one molecule. But if you were to extract the entire cannabis plant, you would have hundreds of thousands of different molecules. And that is a very chemodiverse sample. It has many, many, many different compounds in it. And those compounds are going to interact with your body in different ways than what just THC would interact with your body. And it has a very large therapeutic potential because of that.
Right, like altering specific ratios within that formulation. So we are talking a lot about THC and CBD, and we talk a lot about even the other rare cannabinoids that are gaining traction, right? Like CBN or CBG, THCV. There's so much more than that, and there's so much more that goes into it. And the system in the brain as well, like we talk about the CB1 receptor a lot. So the endocannabinoid system, the main receptor in that system in the brain is called the CB1 receptor. And it's actually the most common receptor in your entire body. Like it's everywhere. There's large amounts. You got CB1 in your skin, like it's all over the place. And the CB1 receptor is the main receptor that people talk about when we're talking about how cannabis works in the body. Usually we talk about THC being the active molecule. THC binds to the CB1 receptor. It activates the CB1 receptor. It turns it on, and that leads to the effects of cannabis. That is usually the black and white way of looking at how cannabis activates the brain. But the reality is so much more complex than that. There's way more than the CB1 receptor. The endocannabinoid system is made up of many more receptors. We're still discovering different ones that are participating. It's made up of the enzymes and the signaling molecules, and it's also made up of other systems and the interaction between the endocannabinoid system and the other systems. And so that chemodiversity in the human body interacts in a very specific way with the plant's chemodiversity. And, you know, in terms of like our theory paper and where we're going with it, we're basically looking at these formulations in a way that is kind of the opposite of how both of us did our research, which was in isolation, which is interesting that it's just, it's kind of just the complete, a complete 180. I suppose.
Absolutely. But it's something we're both extremely interested in because we both use natural products. So it's not just cannabis where chemodiversity matters. It's essentially all natural products. And we can think of something like bacteria resistance when we think of the importance of chemodiversity, right? If you were to give people a penicillin, or methicillin, right? So one single compound to a bacteria, eventually that bacteria is going to learn to survive even in the presence of methicillin. So it has become resistant. Whereas what if we included many of the compounds from a plant or a bacteria or a fungus, many different compounds that had some antibacterial activity, and then the bacteria would have a more difficult time learning how to become resistant because it doesn't need to become resistant to one compound. It needs to become resistant to dozens of compounds that have different ways of killing that bacteria.
And you would use them at lower concentrations. If there were more of them, you wouldn't need so much of any one. And resistance, like bacterial resistance, or like MRSA, like methicillin resistant staph, the bacterial resistance comes from having prolonged exposure, or like the bacteria only become resistant. It's very comparable to tolerance, to like cannabis tolerance or THC tolerance, which is where you have this prolonged exposure to one thing, and that's how you develop the tolerance or the resistance, as opposed to having an exposure to a lower level of a mixture of things. It would have a much more difficult time you know, developing that. And I think that when we met up and we're talking about chemodiversity for the first time, I think that we talked a little bit about redundancy in nature. Like, and redundant, I feel like redundancy sounds like a negative word, but it's not. It's not in the case of how life needs redundancy, especially in the important systems. Like the important
absolutely. Processes. And this goes back to what I had mentioned before. Like if a certain gene pathway gets cut off and a plant isn't able to do something the way that it would typically do it, it has a different pathway that's going to accomplish the same task, whether it be killing a fungus or protecting from light. It needs that redundancy or it would immediately die. It can't just go get some sunscreen from CVS and slap it on its leaves. It needs redundancy.
It needs to be able to produce that sunscreen on its own, which is why it's so amazing. I think when you brought up redundancy was, I think, our second, or it was one of our like second or third times that we were talking, and I was like, my mind was like blown, and I was just like, thank you so much, TikTok followers. Also, I'll give a shout out. Yes.
Yeah, we seriously cannot thank our TikTok followers enough. Sometimes the app gets a bad reputation, which is understandable, but it really is a fantastic way to get free educational content out to a massive audience. And we really wouldn't be here doing this podcast if it wasn't for the support of our TikTok followers. So again, thank you so much.
Honestly, the thing that really blew me away was how many people there are out there who are interested in the science. And not just the basic science, but the deeper knowledge and understanding of how and why cannabis works for you individually. It's all of you out there and your curiosity that keeps us going. Because our ultimate goal is not just to research and understand the therapeutic benefits of natural products, but it's to help others understand it too, so that you can apply it to your lives. Which brings me to a common question both of us get asked. We're regularly asked for strain recommendations for specific symptoms. While there's definitely some evidence out there in the collective human experience for strain-specific effects, there's not enough research to support us being able to know without a lot of trial and error how a strain will help a specific person. This is just one of the pieces in our theory and in our current research projects together. And in terms of like being able to say like this strain will always help, like I think we're both getting asked all the time about recommendations, and we are still not there yet where we can say that, right? Where we can say.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we definitely are not there yet. Maybe in the future, but we're going to need a lot of like meta-analysis of different, we've talked about this before, we're going to essentially have to combine like genomics with metabolomics and create this like insane algorithm plot thing to help us understand all of these different molecules in cannabis and how they help certain populations with certain diseases or ailments.
And we're then going to have to pair that with a similarly complex map of the human body.
Right.
And the human brain that somehow takes into account like prior experience, like changes in your body chemistry because of your microbiome, like in your absorption and things. And I think that, you know, before we, I think, you know, we have some really, really large and lofty scientific goals between the two of us in terms of cannabis and formulations of cannabis and what we want to do in bringing this science to the general public and how people apply it. And I don't know. I mean, I'm an optimist, so I think that they're achievable. I think that even if they're not, maybe we can contribute to future generations of,
I mean, I honestly, I mean, I'm biased and also an extremely toxic optimist.
But I don't think it's toxic. I don't think those two words belong together, because I think optimism is the perspective of an optimist, I think, is conducive to shooting high and getting a lot done.
Oh, absolutely. But I mean, essentially, I think we're already making strides, but changing the status quo of research, but also like we're two research scientists with our PhDs who use cannabis daily. And I think that alone is going to make some changes that I would have loved to have seen 5 years ago.
So now that you've heard all our hopes and dreams for changing the stigma of cannabis through science and education, I'm going to make a request. Please, please send us any questions you have or topics you would like for us to cover. You can find the links to our social media in the description. Our next podcast is going to be a deep dive into cannabis and pain. We're going to piece apart the different types of pain and how the endocannabinoid system is involved at multiple steps. And if you work at a dispensary or cannabis processing facility and you're interested in creating products made with Smokinol that have unique formulations not found in other edibles, please reach out through the contact form in the description. So that's it. Hope you all enjoyed this session and have a great day.